everybody, my name's Neil White, and from Backpage, this is the big interview with Graham Hunter at the Euros. It's Saturday morning, June 19th, the morning after England 0, Scotland 0, a game, from what I can gather from my morning's reading, viewed entirely differently on either side of the border. Today is also match day dos por España. They play Poland in the late game tonight, and Graham Hunter is in Seville with Luis Enrique's squad. Portugal v Germany also coming up today, and France play Hungary at 2 p.m. UK. What a day of football. But Graham, let's start with last night. What do you think Steve Clarke's objectives were before the game began? And do you think Scotland were successful in achieving them?
First of all, and it's not what you're asking, I think his objective was to name a team which is closer to the one that could represent Scotland best in this match. He missed that opportunity in the first game. And this isn't a coruscating criticism, because I think that it's all very well us criticising afterwards, but clearly in the first game, if Steve Clarke saw something that said that it was better to have Lyndon Dykes because he thought that the Czechs were susceptible aerially, then you can unpick it. And if we were sitting here and he was having a little half pint of Guinness with us, I'm certain that by the end of a 20-minute conversation, we'd be a lot more open to the idea of why Gilmore didn't start, so on and so forth. And I think it hurt Scotland. If you look at last night, it hurt Scotland in the first game more than people have talked about, that Tierney was absent. So his first objective had to have been, how do I get my 11 correct? Tierney seems to have been touch and go. If I understand it correctly, it was a calf injury. That's a monster thing to say to somebody. You're going to be tested against some of the best in Europe on a hugely wet pitch at the end of a long season. And, you know, I'm going to need you, by the way, on, I don't know, is it Tuesday or Wednesday? Wednesday, it might be Tuesday. And I've got to return you to your holidays and your clubs. So, you know, starting Tierney looks to have been a no-brainer now, but I'm certain it wasn't. And I think most of us would have expected a busier midfield and maybe only Che Adams up front. Again, he didn't do that. And I think that's the beginning of the answer to your question, in that he didn't ever want England to create superiority by allowing either their fullbacks or the central defenders in particular, I guess particularly Stones, to come past the challenge, to have space, to move into midfield so that the players who were receiving from him could drop off their man. And in the instance of stopping Stones playing, it felt like, in answer to your question, at least this is the way I looked at it, the principal idea for the poor old two strikers wasn't necessarily that they should score. I think his ideas were that there might be a goal coming from midfield, that there might be a goal coming from a set play. But what he asked Dykes and Che Adams to do was work egregiously hard, which not enthusiasm, not ambition alone can do for you. They must be in pretty superb condition. At the end of this season, to put in a stint like that, where it was England across the board who began to look much more weary, slower of thought, and a press like that, where it's not a high press, where you're backed up, where the two strikers basically have to make utter nuisances of themselves, that is a thankless, tiring shift. And normally, elite footballers can pass their way out of that. And Stones in particular has been taught how to do that. In my opinion, it told us something about Stevie Clarke thinks about Mings. I think he thought that Stones was a little bit isolated in ability to play the ball out. And I wonder if retrospectively Southgate looks at the defensive pairing in midfield, which was so important against Croatia and worked very well, and Phillips was at or around the best player, and Rice had a good game. I wonder if he now thinks that he could have used one of those plus more space-creating, ball-playing footballers in the middle of the pitch for him, i.e. whether you want to call Grealish a midfielder or an attacking wide striker, it doesn't matter what you call him. When he came on, it was flipping pandemonium. And part of Steve Clarke's agenda, and again, I say this with respect, was a basketball fouling strategy on Grealish when he came on, and that was clearly pre-arranged. This guy can cause havoc. Don't let him create spaces. And we just gave him a bump or two every now and again. And Matteo Laws, if he did catch on, didn't quite think that he had to stamp his authority more than he did. Jack Grealish will be pissed off this morning, bruised, and McGinn will be texting him going, listen, sorry mate, it's nothing personal, that was just our strategy. And so the absolutely crucial thing wasn't simply that the midfield offered defence protection, even though we had nominally five at the back. It was that they would keep the ball and make England chase a little bit. And I think that's probably why everybody's so excited about the game, because if you compare pass accuracy at home to Czech Republic and away to England, really, realistically, it should have gone down. We're about 83% pass accuracy against the Czechs at Hampden, and nearly 88% pass accuracy against England. Numbers don't generally turn me on that much, but they do tell a tale of what we're going to focus on probably, which was how hugely impressive the midfield was. And I thought you asked Scotland to play with confidence and comfort on the ball, and they did it. And that's a rarity across both your life and my life, that Scotland against elite opponents can play confidently on the ball and pass it and slow things down or accelerate when the time is right. And in that sense, it was admirable.
Well, let's get onto the midfield, but I don't think you can really talk about the midfield and the way they gave Scotland such a great platform to achieve that result without talking about the two out of the three changes in the back three, because having Kieran Tierney and Scott McTominay as a defender, it just meant that the defence, we could pass out of defence in a way that wasn't possible with the three that Scotland had against the Czech Republic in the first game.
Yeah, I agree with you completely, and I think that it probably has gone under the radar how many times McTominay won the ball or jostled for it effectively and made it very, very difficult for England to play. I thought he had a super game. I still think in many quarters Tierney's not properly recognised. And I don't mean after last night. I don't think people properly recognise exactly how good a footballer he is, how well he reads the game. I think that's the thing. He's ferocious. He's aggressive. He's adventurous when he needs to be. And it's been proven that he's adaptable when he's being asked to play in a back three. But I think he's just an exceptional reader of the game. And McTominay, again, is a really ferocious competitor. And like you say, he's a good footballer. And clearly those three added to the two wing-backs. And maybe we won't use the same adjectives about O'Donnell, but O'Donnell wasn't far away from Scotland's best player, impact-wise. In midfield, first of all, I think there's something that links them in that Gilmore, sadly because of injury, hasn't played a lot of football this season. And McGregor's had injuries such that I think he's slightly fewer games this season than he would normally have had. And I thought their energy levels were exceptional. I mean, okay, by the time Billy Gilmore was taken off, you could understand it. He'd run himself to a standstill. He really had stood out in terms of confidence and energy. And, you know, there are big question marks over Gilmore. One of which is he left-footed or right-footed? The other is he going to be a defensive organising midfielder, or could he play off the strikers and look like one of the most gifted players in Europe? And the other big question mark hanging over him is, if there's ever an international football transfer market between countries, how could we ever keep hold of the little bugger? I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, so this is maybe heretical, but he doesn't look Scottish. Do you know what I mean? There's little traces of Gundogan, there's little traces of Iniesta in there. There's a ferocity. I don't know who used the Kante comparison, which is, you're like, well, hold on, steady on for a second. One of the things I think that I notice about him is that he's much, much stronger. His top body is stronger, he holds things off. He's not scared of a challenge at all, but physically, still given his size, I think he does more of using the momentum of somebody coming in behind him to roll them and go away from them. And like Tierney, I think he's got a really quick anticipation of space and where people are, and that, I don't know if it's imagination and peripheral vision, but he's got the gift of knowing what he wants to do, finding a man, but doing it really swiftly. So there's a fluidity. He's not, you know, the number one gift we'd have prayed for Scotland had we all the chance, because that's a striker and has been for just to all our lives, really. If we had somebody who could put goals in when we were on top, put dirty goals in off his backside when we're not on top, Scotland, with this squad and Ernest Clark, would be a genuine menace. And we don't quite have that yet. But if you wanted to say, well, what next? Well, it would be somebody that makes the midfield look fluid and calm and competitive, and where we look classy. And if you were in a midfield where Rice and Phillips and Mount and Foden are all buzzing around you, and you've got to not let it lose the ball, where you've got to win it back, which he did regularly, and you've got to add the calmness that Scotland regularly do not show, particularly away against big sides, then Gilmour couldn't have done it much better. But I think that given how little football he's played this season for Chelsea, that's a frustration to everybody who loves good football. But his energy levels, I thought, were really good. And Neil, did you see the quote? This was to Alex O'Henley from the UEFA website. Andy Robertson said, maybe he said this widely, but he said, I went to see Billy Gilmour in the hotel in the afternoon, just to chat him through, see how he was. Andy Robertson said, I came out of the room more confident that we were going to win than we could. He went in to check on the wee man, the flipping guy who's just turned 20 last week on June the 11th. And this hard-bitten Premier League winning, European Cup raising, tough nut, who's our captain, came out more confident about the result. That's Billy Bonkers, not Billy Gilmour.
I read quite a bit about the game this morning. It's always fun, you know, to see how your opinion of a football match aligns with everybody who's been writing about it. It will come as no surprise to you that one of the more insightful and interesting pieces came from Jonathan Liu, who described a system that has been built around Harry Kane failing because Harry Kane looks in less than peak physical condition at the end of a season, not for the first time. I don't know how much of England's sort of failure to launch can be attributed to that, but we had exactly the same conversation after their group opener, that when Southgate eventually makes the change, Rashford for Kane, he could have probably done it even earlier.
One, this echoes back to your original question, because most of what Scotland were doing had the ultimate aim, but even before you talk about drawing or winning, about making sure that Kane didn't get good service. And, you know, I think Kane was also well patrolled. And I think that even if Grant Hanley, in your description, is the bronze medal of the three central defenders, each of them patrolled him well. I thought McTominay worked him physically well. But he didn't get a massive amount of quality possession. And if you know, 1 + 1 sometimes equals 3, if you get a big unit of a guy who is physically tired and you're saying to him on a rainy night under pressure, you're going to be feeding off scraps, Kane has got the ability in certain league games to say, I don't care, that's fine, I will dominate. But it happened that last night it was the perfect storm for him. And if you're arguing that Southgate could have replaced him earlier, I agree. I think if Rashford wasn't suffering from such shoulder problems, which has definitely hampered his form, and heavens above, if Kane was firing on top form and either Rashford started with him or was brought on, I think we'd have been talking about a very different prospect for Scotland, a very different prospect for the guys who were trying to use the ball for England, because you can then use the ball one on the break much more. And there were one or two times when Scotland had the ball put in behind them by England. It's also, we're in a far greater threat at set plays where we already just about conceded what might have been the winner to Stones. So I haven't read Jonathan's piece, but I think it's patently clear to anybody who watches football that Harry Kane's pretty knackered. Other people will be asking questions about, I think we did this in one podcast about, do you want to be in the middle of a transfer move as a big tournament comes along? It cost David Silva masses of game time at World Cup 2010. Other Spain players deliberately said to their suitors, get this done before the championship, the big tournament, or don't talk to me at all. I have no idea. I'm certainly not pointing my finger at Harry Kane. But I think if he was able to run his life differently, then in the backward chain of events, you don't sign a 362-year contract with Daniel Levy, you know, which might be felt to be a bit restrictive. And you don't get hacked off with losing a manager and still no trophy and still no Champions League football just before you're about to go into the tournament where probably you should be in the form of your life. And you're going to play 90% of the games at Wembley and you should win. Can he take the stuff that's weighing him down, tiredness, lack of supply, and any kind of gremlins that are in his head about, am I running out of time here with England and with Spurs, and shake them off and dominate the game against the Czechs or score?
Okay, listen, it's time for a quick break before we get all the news from the Spain camp as they prepare for their next game later tonight.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back. Graham, let's talk Spain and Poland. Just as Che Adams kind of had to start for Scotland after the way their opener went, are we certain to see Gerard Moreno up front for Spain?
That's not the point, apparently, according to Luis Enrique. That's not the point at all. And by the way, dzień dobry, as the Poles would say. Good morning. It was fascinating to watch him yesterday. He didn't do a lot of media work early in the morning, but he did some, and he said immediately, he's the kind of guy that if you said to him, if you were serving him his breakfast and said, "Would you like toast, sir?" None of your business. So asking him about the team, but in the morning he said it's Alvaro Morata and 10 others. He never gives, he's like Pep Guardiola is too, he's obsessive about secrecy about the lineup, the tactics, the changes he might make. Alvaro Morata. Marca are very good this morning. Instead of Alvaro Morata and 10 more, like Luis Enrique said, they've got the front cover saying Alvaro Morata and 13,000 others. So it's a nice, it's subtlety about, like, even though Marca will be the first to beat him with a big stick if there isn't a goal tonight, today they're saying, get behind him to the fan. There'll be about 13,000 Spaniards in the stadium. So get behind Morata. And that was all very interesting, as was, none of the papers seem to think that Busquets is starting because he passed another COVID test and it was negative on Thursday night. It meant that by the time those results came in at breakfast time, Busquets was announced as clear to return to the squad, which he did to huge applause and people, the players, Busy, shouting his name and all that kind of nonsense. And Luis Enrique said, well, he's not the idea. The papers have been writing that Busquets might just sniff the Slovakia game. Luis Enrique said, look, his GPS tracker data says that the training he's been doing at home, because he's been asymptomatic, means he's in perfect condition. I've been in touch with him all the time. He's not discarded for the Poland game. Now, none of the papers think he's starting. But there was another little nugget of information from Luis Enrique who could have said, you know, I'm not telling you, none of your business, or no, he's out, and then throw him in, or blah, blah, blah. So it was an unusually loquacious mood on Friday morning. I have to say that unless the papers have been briefed, I think there's still a decent chance that Busquets plays. But that wasn't your question. Gerard Moreno should have started the first game. It's a Billy Gilmore situation, just like the Che Adams. I think it was an error that he didn't start. I watched closely when he came on and in training sessions subsequently. Was there a hint of a knock? Hint of protection that doesn't seem to have been. Let's wait and see again, but it just seems to have been that Luis Enrique thought, no, Morata and Ferran and Olmo will do the job for us. Largely, it's believed at the moment that not only should the two M's, you know, dial M for mayhem, play together, Morata and Moreno, but that they will. Moreno is the more technical player. Gerard Moreno is the more technical player, there's no question. But Morata is a big unit. He's quick, he's very, very good in the air. And if you're forgiving, you look at the number of chances he's been involved in over the last two games rather than the misses. Morata is not unhappy if you ask him to be not a winger but play on the line, coming in, trying to isolate a fullback and get the ball over the top. Morata's perfectly happy in that big, rangy, aggressive running that a centre forward who's athletic can do if he goes left or right. And Moreno is flexible enough that he prefers to play like Benzema, 9.5. Not an outright centre forward, but not an outright 10 either. That's the position he loves most. But if you, because he's very left footed, if you put him on the right and he's coming in onto that left foot, then his use of the ball, slide passes, that risk, Moreno's got that. And coming in off the right, it's easily the case that you could see complete fluidity, almost happy enough being a false nine. So the Poles, particularly missing Krychowiak, who was sent off in the first game, he's a very good defence protection man. I think he's a good footballer, point full stop. And I think that Glick at centre-back has been obviously a good footballer. He's only 33, but I see him as having needed a little bit more defence protection. I wonder if it's going to be Jacob Modo, who I haven't seen much of at Brighton, but clearly one of the things Luis Enrique can do over and above the videos that his analysts give him is go and speak to Robert Sanchez about Modo. Has he got flaws? Do you see him in training? Does he turn quickly? If he gets knocked over, does he complete? Just little things like that. Whether Luis Enrique does that with his Brighton goalkeeper or not, I don't know, but it's what I would do. And I would have thought with that fluidity up front, if it's Morata, Moreno and Dani Olmo, and Olmo outshone Torres the other day. Torres is clearly the more complete, greater footballer, and his goal record for Spain is very, very good. But I think that Olmo's performance against Sweden probably meant that if there's a third forward, it's likely to be him. Then you've got a heap more questions about if he's the pivotee, then who plays either side of him? Well, that almost guarantees that if Busquets is in, it'll be Pedri. It's because you've got this brilliant club connection and it's instinctive, it's automatismos that anybody who's listened to our podcast knows of. If it's not Busquets, if it's Rodri, or if it's Thiago at the pivote, how does that? What choices does that guide you to in terms of who plays right midfield and left midfield? And on and on and on it goes. And the last thing I'll leave you with, I think it's too early to see Luis Enrique changing system. But he is not avowedly against 3-5-2. Paulo Sousa for Poland had them playing 3-5-2 in the last game that they lost when they were down to 10 men and Chesney had a stinker when the ball bounced back in off him. We talked about that in the last podcast. Matching a 3-5-2 is not an outlandish idea. And what that does then, the reason it excites me a little bit is that Azpilicueta comes in at right centre-back and Llorente then as a wing-back is just automatically a little bit higher up the pitch. The goal threat that he brings is augmented and, we could get that charge feeling, but that's not a very Luis Enrique idea, so maybe that's just a flight of fancy.
It seems counterintuitive to think that Spain will change a midfield that just recorded a championship record number of both passes attempted and passes completed in their previous game.
Yeah, but I understand that. So your description is brilliant about counterintuitive. I understand that, but there has to be. I look back at the stats, and it's just a tiny glimpse. I look back at the stats. You know, Scotland had better possession than the Czech Republic and lost 2-0. I think Scotland had better pass accuracy than the Czech Republic and lost 2-0. I think the Peter Perfect, Mary Poppins idea about like everything is neat and tidy in the garden, Chancy Gardner, isn't enough. We know that Pedri and Busquets and Thiago and Koke can do it right and do it right. But you're not talking about efficiency. That's the big, big difference. Efficiency and efficacy. And they just, E's are good. So you need to change your EE numbers. And you want to go efficacy, and it's fine if their pass numbers go down by 50, and their pass accuracy goes down by 10%, and they win 2-0, and that to me is not like abandoning the efficiency. It's about accepting taking more risks, maybe the earlier pass, maybe the pass where you think, well, maybe they don't stand in and think sort of Robocop way about like that, there's a 72% chance of me making that pass. And but more creative risk, the acceptance of maybe having to chase to press to win the ball back, or maybe winning the ball back by the press being more aggressive, more adventurous. I think that that is one of the things, alongside Pausa, and maybe hoping that Poland make more mistakes than Sweden did, because Sweden really didn't make that. There was one beauty. There was one where whoever the central defender was kind of slips and falls over, and that was Morata's best chance. And maybe we see that from Poland today. I don't know, but there's a theme from Spain that they need to be efficient in denying Lewandowski possession the way that Scotland denied Kane possession, but effective in saying, there's a risky pass, we're going to probe that guy, we're going to test him, we're going to turn him, bingo, seventh time of asking, there's the goal.
Okay, listen, it's time for our Player of the Day feature. This is brought to you by Bet365, our sponsor for these shows. Graham, open to you today are the participants of Spain versus Poland, of course, the game that you will be at, Hungary versus France, or Portugal versus Germany?
The number of options in this match to pick Bet365 Man of the Day aren't only dazzling, but you've given me complete freedom to invent the reason for picking this, which, given my maverick nature, is probably very wise on your part. If you discard a couple of the obvious ones, in order for Germany to progress, it would be Man of the Day style for Manuel Neuer to do one of his octopus performances, save a penalty, and then nod in a header in the last minute. It was well within his range. And it could be Joachim Löw. His Germany side has thrilled us. So I'd like to pick him, but I'm not going to. Nor will I pick little Bruno, who's in a Cantona-esque effect on Manchester United. I'm going to go for an oddball, which is Josh Kimmich, because he's unlikely to win the game. But he was talking in the build-up to this match about his position being the joker position. And you hear that phrase in different languages, where like a guy who can play in lots of different areas and you just play a joker in a certain delineation depending on who you think the opposition is and what your team needs. So he can play right back, he can play right wing back, which is, if it's a 3-4-3, is kind of what he will be playing. I thought he was scintillating against France. I thought Kimmich was just... It wasn't just that he was everywhere, that almost every touch was perfect. It was like, here's the central driving force. Here's the guy who's trying to take his team and the game and the tournament by the scruff of the neck and drag an 8-stone weakling Germany side through. So they'll need that. I think Portugal can win this game. I think they might win this game. They'd be my, if you pushed me, they'd be my slight tips to win. For Germany to lose twice in a row at home in the space of a matter of days in Munich would be catastrophic. You'd need Das boot up the arse, never mind Das reboot, in order to solve that problem. But if there's somebody who's going to drag Germany through this experience, and he had a little dig at reporters who asked him, do you think you'll be playing in right central midfield instead of right back or right wing back? He said, well, you've missed a chance. You should have asked the coach. I'm not telling you. And so he's in playful mood. He's an exceptional footballer, plucked from... can't remember where it was. Was it Leipzig? I can't remember where he was plucked from by Pep Guardiola, whose tapes had showed him this is the guy we have to go and get. And he and his team of inside men hopped in a car, went off, had a last look, signed him. And Bayern have got a gem. Kimmich is a wonderful, exciting, inspirational footballer to watch. And therefore, even though my suspicion is that he might be on the losing side today, I'm going to go Josh Kimmich, Mr. Kimmich. Das ist du.
That's everything for today. Graham will be back overnight with one of his quick takes immediately after his night at La Cartuja is done. I love those episodes and I hope that you do too, listener. Thank you for being there today and I hope you enjoy the football.